Everyone has lost their minds.
So the guys filming all this, they're transgender.
I pay my money. I have a right.
I am a customer.
You know what? Let's call ICE.
Chicken jockey.
You're not that guy, pal. Trust me. You're not that guy. Yeah? Absolutely.
It feels like no one knows how to exist in a goddamn society anymore. And I think we can understand what's going on with the help of a book that Jean-Paul Sartre wrote while ripped on amphetamines. Sartre's ideas can help us understand precisely why the internet is breaking our brains and destroying society, and how we are sort of letting this happen.
Unprecedented coronavirus.
Coronavirus, they used that word in 2019.
These outbursts and wildly uncomfortable moments aren't just examples of someone being filmed on their worst day. Rather, they expose the ways in which the internet has enabled us to live in distinct realities.
There was more CO2 released from that one volcano erupting than everything human beings have ever done. Fact checked, volcanoes do not produce more CO2 emissions than human activity.
Reuters is on your ass.
Unable to speak with or even understand each other, all while using that rage and anger to fuel the digital systems creating these dystopian realities. And the only way to get out of this hole is to first understand why in the hell we went down there in the first place. Now, if you've gone to a movie theater since 2020, you're probably aware that a shocking amount of human people act like absolute monsters.
I want more than just a replay.
Okay.
Can I get a drink?
I've seen people playing video games with the sound on, laughing at rather than with a movie, answering phone calls, Googling what is this movie about, and passing out during the first hour of Wakanda Forever, and then snoring throughout the rest of the movie. Disrespectful to Chadwick Boseman. It all led me to start going to the Alamo Drafthouse, where they make a big show about how if you talk or text during the movie, they're gonna kick you out.
I might be the Joker, but one thing I don't joke about is movies. And if you planned on talking or texting during this movie, please don't.
Now, if we think of people acting like psychos at the movies in ethical terms, we might realize that when we take our phone out during one battle after another, we're putting our immediate interest over the collective interest of everyone else in our theater who are presumably there to watch the movie. And even if it's not a big deal for me to take out my phone to quickly check Instagram, if everyone was doing that during the entire movie, it would make for an absolutely terrible time. From another ethical point of view, we might reflect on how our phones have completely wrecked our ability to pay attention, as evidenced by having to look at some dude swipe through Tinder during a screening of The Brutalist. Now, if we instead approached a film as an opportunity to cultivate the virtue of disciplined attention, we not only have a more enjoyable film-going experience, but a more stable attention span that could help us live a more meaningful and less distracted life. But while these individual ethical approaches might make sense in a New York Times or Vox article about how to reclaim your attention span or become a better listener, they're focused wholly on individual morality and behavior. I think the more important and interesting question to consider here is why so many of our experiences with others seem to indicate that our social ethic is completely out of joint. With some of us thinking that a movie is time to, you know, eat too much popcorn and zone out for a bit, while others think it's a great time to text their exes or make a Pornhub playlist for the ride home. But first, I want to thank the sponsor that made this video possible, Rocket Money. Now, one thing about being an adult with a PhD in philosophy is that I'm really bad with money. And while I've gotten a little bit more responsible over the years, I still struggle to keep track of all the little ways that I end up spending money. For example, last year, I realized that I had spent a decade paying for a Netflix DVD subscription that I was not using. But recently, I was able to see all the subscriptions that I'm paying for, and even figure out how to cancel those subscriptions with the help of this video sponsor, Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that allows you to manage subscriptions, lower bills, make a custom budget, and grow your savings all in one place. I've lost track of all of the random subscriptions that I have, and seeing them all laid out in one place on the Rocket Money app immediately made me realize that I was paying for a couple of things that I rarely use, and they made it really easy for me to cancel them. The budget feature is also super helpful because it shows how you're spending your money each month, which is like having to stare your ADHD-fueled financial decisions teens right in the face and say, my bad. So if you're also a grown adult who struggles to wrap your head around financial reality, use my link to start a free trial of Rocket Money. Now just scan this QR code or click the link in the description to get started for free. You can also unlock even more features with Premium, which I have been using. Okay, now that we've saved ourselves a little bit of money, let's get back to talking about how no one seems to be able to exist in society anymore. So what would it take for us to reclaim some shared sense of social reality? Let's take the rules at an Alamo Drafthouse. Now, they formalize the usual no phones while the lights are off of a standard theater. Now, by seeing a movie there, you agree to a social contract by which you won't talk or text during the film. And you're aware that if you do, a fellow movie lover can inform an employee and have you removed. Now, while everyone in the theater might be strangers, they're all aware of the shared logic and rules of seeing movies at Alamo Drafthouse, because they tell you a lot. They tell you a lot when you're there. This is similar to what Jean-Paul Sartre describes as seriality in his book, The Critique of Dialectical Reason. The idea explains how in our normal lives, we often go along with predetermined rules and social structures, basically acting like everyone else for the sake of getting along and getting things done. And in doing so, we're not really expressing any individual freedom or ambition. So when a movie theater creates a rule against cell phone usage or talking, it introduces a new logic of social decorum where following this set of manners ensures that everyone is able to accomplish their individual goal of watching a movie. Sartre describes seriality by using the logic of waiting for the bus, where everyone knows that to accomplish their goal, which is, you know, getting on the bus and traveling to their destination, they need to wait in line, board when it's their turn, pay their fare, and then take a seat. By existing in this social series, everyone ensures the best possibility of the bus ride going according to plan. And that might sound desirable and like a good model for a social ethic, but Sartre notes that rather than enacting their freedom, each member of a series is equally impotent. This is where it'd be funny if I was like, this video is sponsored by Hims. If you don't want to be impotent, take pills to give you boners. Take pills. You know, back in my day, you just had to have a penis that didn't work well or go bald. And now it's like, oh, have a boner 24/7 and have good hair no matter what. Now, everyone submits to the rules of the series because their individual resistance wouldn't really accomplish anything. We're not creating connections with others in this series. We're simply reinforcing a law that we must all follow. And in these situations, we're acting freely only in as much as we're free to follow the rules or to be excluded from the series. At the Alamo, the rules state that if you see someone on their phone or talking during a movie, you can write down your complaint on a piece of paper and then pass it to a server, which means that you have to become a cop or at least an informant, which feels bad. I've personally never been able to do it. I've sat by some annoying people, but My mama did not raise a snitch, so I still didn't have it in me to do. Also, it's a weird one because then I know that I'm giving that piece of paper to probably an underpaid 23-year-old just fighting for their union rights who now has to go do an uncomfortable interaction with a person who's probably a dick. So enjoying the movie without distraction comes at the expense of imposing a strict law onto all moviegoers. And the same serial logic applies at our workplaces, right? Because we might want to speak up about mistreatment or suggest new ways of doing things or attempt to form a union with our fellow workers. But in doing so, we risk breaking the law of the series and being punished or even fired. This is especially true in a situation where there is a scarcity of employment opportunities. You know, there aren't enough jobs for everyone, and I know that if I don't play my part, someone else likely will. So even if a serial social ethic sounds attractive in as much as it makes our day-to-day social existence more well-ordered, it only works when we're all submitting to one overarching social logic out of a fear of being left out if we don't. Basically, I can follow the rules or I can miss the bus. Shout out to anyone that had the song I Missed the Bus by Chris Cross in their head when I said that line. If that was you, I think we'd be friends. But what if to live a more truly cohesive and free social existence, we actually need to break with this type of well-ordered seriality? And by pushing up against the limits of serial logic, we're able to will our freedom collectively and change our social and political realities. Well, to see how this works, let's consider the era that many have isolated as the start of our modern collapse of social behavior, this spring of 2020. A time that for many of us was a moment where all the shit hit all the fans at once, and if you were lucky, you at least had a mask to stop all the shit from getting in your mouth. Now, according to many, the combined effects of social isolation, political uncertainty, and anxiety about health risk impaired our ability to socially exist once lockdowns and restrictions were lifted, and we re-entered society after the initial phase of the COVID-19 outbreak. But what this analysis ignores is that 2020 was also a time where it felt like we were on the verge of truly radical social change, one especially marked by a new type of social solidarity and a more inclusive social ethic. From a public health perspective, we saw acts of collective support for healthcare workers, while communities took care of vulnerable people and organized community fridges and mutual aid projects. Government financial and health assistance helped us realize that we didn't need to work every day and that the government could offer us basic income and health care without collapsing. It also gave many an amount of time off that they had not experienced since they were children, self-included. Shout out to time off during COVID. I talked about this in my recent burnout video. You can watch that video if you want. It wasn't just a global pandemic that led to these shifts, as the murder of George Floyd led to a series of protests that quickly became national and even international. In my own community, protests during lockdown led to a new sense of social solidarity that broke with a sense of pre-existing seriality. And the eventual mass protests that took place here in Los Angeles opened up a new horizon of social and political possibility as hundreds of thousands of people organized against white supremacy, police violence, and capitalism. Those are your three favorite things. Shout it out in the comments. These events broke us out of our business as usual attitudes and to a reconsideration of our relations to both our neighbors and our larger communities in light of events happening around us. It was like being shaken out of something. Now, in Sartre's terms, these events broke the chain of seriality and put us into a new type of relation with each other and the world around us. Because when something breaks this business as usual approach, whether that be the bus showing up late, the emergence of a global pandemic, or a large scale reckoning with police violence, we're able to snap out of this seriality and take on a new type of relation to those around us. Now, Sartre referred to these moments as the end of serial existence and the beginning of what he called groups in fusion, which are collectives of individuals oriented around a shared project. These groups emerge by rejecting the normal social order, and the individuals in these groups work collectively to build something different. And in this way, they interact with each other more authentically, sharing in a common project, even if their association is not formally structured. They're no longer just following the rules of the world as it is, they're attempting to rebuild the world as it could be. Now, the infusion nature of these groups also makes their bonds more fragile, as they're sort of building the plane on the way down, so to speak. Sartre writes that the group is defined by its undertaking and by the constant movement to eliminate all forms of inertia from it. Now, we can understand this further by going back to Sartre's example of people waiting for the bus. Now, he describes individuals waiting for the bus outside of a church. He notes that they're all isolated individuals in competition for a scarce resource. Seats on the bus. And from the perspective of the bus or the project of the bus, they're all the same, essentially interchangeable. And as long as the bus shows up, they continue to exist in this seriality. However, if the bus fails to show up, and especially if it does so repeatedly, well, they might join together to attempt to solve the problem, in the process establishing a group infusion with the shared project of improving bus service. Now, they might accomplish that goal and then dissolve back into seriality. Or this might lead to them getting involved in larger projects to improve public transit, leading to new forms of organization. But this could always collapse back into seriality. And I want to emphasize that a form of scarcity both established this initial seriality, but then also led to the formation of a group infusion, right? The scarcity of spots on the bus creates a sense of individual competition amongst these serial individuals. But the further scarcity of the bus, like when it doesn't show up, leads to the emergence of the group infusion. And during 2020, we were made aware of the scarcity of everything from healthcare resources to food to toilet paper to vaccines. And community health and mutual aid groups emerged often as new groups infusion to respond to these points of scarcity. But it is worth noting that while scarcity can lead to community refrigerators and protests against a racist police state, it can also lead to some very not cool shit, which we also saw in 2020. I just kicked over a bottle of water and spilled it all over my floor. And because my house is old and tilted, it started all draining one direction. That's good. That's fun. But let's focus. Let's make some content, Michael. Let's make some content. The best recent depiction I've seen of this is Ari Aster's 2025 film Eddington, a film that he described as exploring what it feels like to live in a world where nobody agrees unless actually happens. The film takes place in the small town of Eddington, New Mexico, and explores the overlapping reactions to the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic and the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, each character has a worldview shaped via their interaction with some corner of the online world.
This is not a secret. Please look it up. They did a whole pandemic modeling exercise at Johns Hopkins.
Aster has said that it's a movie where everybody's living on the internet. They're all living in different realities, and they're unreachable to each other.
I know one of them was fired for excessive force, and another one was forced to quit by a YouTube First Amendment auditor.
Okay, yes, that is the same auditor that drove away your work.
Your undersheriff died of a fentanyl overdose.
From handling fentanyl.
And your captain. And your chief deputy took jobs in Rio Rancho.
That was devastating.
You can't keep your own office going, but you're going to run mine.
The only thing the residents of Eddington seem to have in common is that their realities are all mediated or straight up manufactured by the internet. And looming in the background of the film is the construction of a massive AI data center right outside the town's limits. And of course, by the end of 2020, America was feeling pretty Eddington-y. You know, Bernie Sanders wasn't the president. January 6th was about to pop off. And more than ever, we were in a new era of competing ideological frameworks, all mediated by various social platforms and online communities.
Basically, there's rumors speculating online that the Chinese government, you know about Gaia Force?
No.
What if I told you this was actually a document?
The Chinese government figured out how to hack into the guy first.
Which could make us ask, was Jean-Paul Sartre full of shit? You know, why does the same event or sense of scarcity lead some people to attempt to build a new model of collective freedom, while for others it spawns exclusionary and conspiratorial movements? You know, one man's Medicare for all is another man's Stop the Steal protest. And we can answer this via the work of a philosopher working in Sartre's legacy, Alain Badiou. Now, much of his work can be read as a less speed-laced and more formalized version of Sartre's project in The Critique of Dialectical Reason. Badiou uses the term event to describe what happens when a new truth emerges that breaks with the serialized logic of an existing situation. And he refers to those who respond to this event as a type of group infusion as the faithful subject of the event. And while Badiou himself is an atheist, he does use the example of religious conversion to describe this. So if that is helpful in making sense of what this type of subjectivity and faith looks like, well, there you go. I'm glad that helped. So we could say that those who saw the scarcity in the American healthcare system during the COVID outbreak and responded with the creation of new community healthcare collectives were being faithful subjects to a particular truth. But Badiou also considers what happens when people experience an event and don't respond faithfully, but rather by becoming what he calls obscure or reactionary subjects. Now, the obscure subject negates the event in the present and affirms instead some true event from the past. This often looks like appeals to God, race, or nationality in the face of events which challenge the status quo. And I think in post-2020 America, we can use this concept to better understand the rise of nationalism and specifically white Christian nationalism. When writing about this in the book Logic of Worlds, Badiou associates this position with veterans of lost wars, illiterate, muscle-bound youths, xenophobes, and cuckolded husbands. Let me know which one you are in the comments. Now, the reactionary subject also refuses to recognize the truth of the event, but they don't completely disregard it. Instead, they consider it via the dominant order of knowledge in a given situation. The reactionary both denies the novelty of the event or the new thing, while also absorbing some of its traits into the dominant system of knowledge. In the context of post-2020 America, this makes me think of Democratic politicians kneeling in kente cloths, or gushers posting that they stand with Black Lives. Thank you, gushers. These responses, the obscure and the reactionary, can help us understand why different groups have responded to the interrelated crises of the past 5 years in diametrically opposed ways, seemingly conveying alternative understandings of reality. But while COVID might have exacerbated what was happening, I don't think it's the cause of all of this. For that, we need to go back to the night of November 8th, 2016, at the Javits Center in Manhattan. Hillary Clinton was set to defeat Donald Trump and become the first president to break the glass ceiling of the U.S. presidency.
And finally, her campaign believes that as she addresses the world under this glass ceiling at the Javits Center, she will finally be shattering once and for all that glass ceiling by becoming America's first woman president.
All of the most important politics understanders had assured us that her victory was imminent.
It looks like Hillary is ready to make history.
Helped in no small part by clips emerging of her opponent talking about grabbing women by the pussy and stuff like that.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the...
The setting for this magical night was a building constructed almost completely out of glass, the perfect architectural metaphor for what Clinton was about to achieve. But then something else happened.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me, but got scared off.
This was a moment where reality started to diverge in ways that we could no longer ignore. The seriality and loose social order of the Obama era had come to an incredibly tacky halt, and our internet-curated realities were starting to become different worlds. The MAGA movement and its British cousin Brexit addressed itself to an underlying sense of scarcity, a sense that there wasn't enough for everyone, and provided the scapegoat of some nefarious others, whether they be migrants, immigrants, brown people, who are going to take your share unless we stop them. The same set of economic conditions that led to the surprising rise of Clinton's Democratic Socialist primary challenger, Bernie Sanders, had also led to a new wave of right-wing populism. If supporters of Sanders pointed towards some radical new political future which questioned dominant political logic, and the MAGA crowd sought to restore the obscure truth of Christianity or the Founding Fathers, Clinton represented a more reactionary truth.
If we broke up the big banks tomorrow, and I will, if they deserve it, if they pose any systemic risk, I will. Would that end racism?
Seeking to appropriate some of the more radical critiques from the left while still paving the way for neoliberalism to remain triumphant. And each of these factions soon found themselves with internet communities to further these emerging groups. You know, for some, that was Alex Jones and Ben Shapiro. For others, you had Pod Save America, while others fell in with Chapo Trap House and the Dirtbag Left. But much like the residents of Eddington, our phones increasingly became our primary gateways to social and political reality. In a recent New York Times article, the host of the TruAnon podcast discussed what they refer to as the mass onboarding event beginning with the pandemic, when millions of Americans began to live online. The effect of this, according to them, is that the internet has radicalized seemingly everyone, from centrist liberals to conservative middle-class voters. Now, while I agree with this analysis, I think that 2016 is when we really see this mass onboarding event begin. Via the increased traction of the Democratic online resistance, as well as the digital soldiers in the MAGA army. While Sartre never lived to see the internet, I mean, imagine how much fun he would have had, you know, snorting some Adderall, loading up Reddit, really going for it. He describes something in the Critique of Dialectical Reason that can help us make sense of how the internet has had such a devastating effect in the offline world. Now, in his attempt to understand the relationship between necessity and freedom, Sartre discusses how our work on the material world can come back and have determining and limiting effects on our freedom and activity. He uses the example of deforestation during the Cultural Revolution in China, leading to long-term flooding, and the rise of steam engines leading to increased industrial factories that then lead to detrimental ecological effects that make our lives less cool. Now, he refers to these as examples of the practico-inert, or worked matter, which describes a form of alienation and in which we are alienated from our own humanity and the humanity of others via the effects of our own human labor. If this is a little heady, I think the most clear contemporary example of this is probably climate change. Humans doing all of this stuff to progress society that then does something to nature that comes back to get us in a way where we become, you know, the objects of nature's activities, things like that. Now, I think this concept, worked matter, can help us understand the internet in a way that makes way more sense of everything that I've been talking about so far. Now, the internet was built by human beings wielding their freedom to create something new. But that thing soon took on a life of its own, and it's now having a determining effect on our humanity and existence and cognitive function. The way Sartre described this under industrialism is that the factory worker became the object of the machine, with the worker adapting to the machine and destroying their body in the process by interiorizing a rhythm which is absolutely other or alien. You know, we work on matter, and then matter determines our existence. We created the internet. Now the internet creates us. A not fun example of this is the recent wave of mass shooters and amateur assassins that are young men radicalized via different internet communities. Tyler Robinson, who shot Charlie Kirk, had written messages on his bullets that he used in the shooting, most of which were just references that only the deeply online would understand.
Inscriptions on a fire casing read, "Notices bulges, capital O-W-O, what's this question mark?"
And as I talked about in my recent video on technology and ICE, ChatGPT, a technology created by humans, recently helped guide a vulnerable teenager to end their own life. In all of these examples, we are experiencing a digital version of worked matter, in which the seemingly dead internet is operating like an undead force on human consciousness and activity. Our economic system necessitated that we pour our labor into creating these digital systems, platforms, and algorithms. And that human labor has now produced a type of worked matter that is having a limiting and determining effect on our own human freedom.
Where human beings are no longer born, we are grown.
I mean, think about how over the past decade, we were all told that you gotta learn to code, you know, just learn to code, study STEM, and you'll have a job forever. But with the emergence of LLMs, it seems like maybe we don't need coders anymore, and that tech workers have basically been helping to dig their own digital graves. And to be clear, I talked about this in a recent video. I'm not immune from this. I make stuff online, and then the internet uses the stuff that people like me make online to then make AI stuff. And soon, like, who's gonna watch it? What's the end game here, you know? Does AI watch content made by other AIs while we just die in the street? Who knows? This is the root of the phenomenon of internet brain. You know, we produced the internet, and now it's producing us. We used to post like how we talked, but now we talk like how we post. No cap. And we see this phenomenon at play in the movie Eddington. Now, while some have critiqued the film for centrism or both-sidism, I think this accusation falls flat once we realize that the true antagonist of the film is the AI data center that's being constructed on the outskirts of town. The film's conclusion emphasizes that at the end of the day, the contemporary use of human freedom is to enable the expansion of these technologies, even if that means they come at the expense of our own humanity. Basically, it's worth draining all of the freshwater lakes in North America if it makes it so that we can make AI porn of Peter from Family Guy eating out Amelia Earhart. As Dustin Guastella writes in Jacobin, what Eddington shows is just how helpless these locales are against forces so much larger than themselves, and how helpless we are against the crazy-making machines they've convinced us to carry in our pockets. Much like how some missed the critical force of this movie by focusing on the individual beliefs and actions of characters rather than the structural conditions of these characters, many of us risk missing the forest for the trees when we latch onto the behaviors of individuals and groups without critically accounting for the conditions that led to the emergence of these groups. You know, to paraphrase Frederick Jameson, another sort of student of Sartre, when we do this, we're failing to identify the totalizing system that can help us understand what's actually going on. I have a couple videos on this. I can link them below. And also, we've been reading Frederick Jameson on my Patreon reading group. All of that is on Patreon if you want to check it out. When we're all yelling at each other about competing social and political ideologies that we've developed via our engagement with rage-fueled platforms, we often miss the proverbial data centers in the distance fueled by this endless argument, which is also refueling those same arguments. I said proverbial, but I guess it really is just a data center. You know, I guess I'm really just referring to the actual data centers. So there you go. You can always learn. But we might still wonder, even if we're better equipped to understand what's actually going on in the world, aren't we just left waiting for external events to help us break out of seriality so we can explore freedom in new ways? Doesn't this all leave us kind of helpless? To which I would answer, yeah, you're right, you know, we're pretty helpless because we're left waiting for political, historical, and cultural events to happen, which highlight human scarcity and force us to reconsider political possibility and the limits of equality. And until something like that happens, I guess we'll just have to hang out and sext with ChatGPT. It sucks that many of our contemporary problems have accelerated to such a level that I don't even know if Sartre could have predicted this. But we have the concepts to understand the system, and we have the ability to break with a digitally mediated serial existence and to imagine the world differently. Even if we are waiting for events to take place that can shake up our collective understanding, we can do the work of cognitive mapping that helps us to understand the system that we're in, so when the time for action comes, we're ready. And if you're looking for a really good double feature to pair with Eddington, I would recommend another 2025 film, One Battle After Another. While Eddington explores the effects of phones and the internet on our sense of political reality, One Battle After Another shows us revolutionaries who avoid contemporary technology like the plague, lest they be tracked by fascists. And it shows us both the good and bad sides of a politics that's grounded in humanity and solidarity. And while I won't argue that getting stoned and watching the Battle of Algiers for the 100th time is actually more politically useful than scrolling Twitter, actually, fuck it, I will. That's definitely better. If your options are to stare at your phone or to watch the Battle of Algiers and get a little stoned, I think that's better. You know what? Yeah, throw your phone in a river and watch that movie over and over. I think that's better for you. In the meantime, let's remember the importance of engaging with other human beings and the larger communities that we find ourselves in more seriously than we are engaging with the internet. Because at the end of the day, maybe what we all need is just to get offline and have a few small beers with our fellow revolutionaries. Guys, thanks for watching this one. A big shout out to all of my patrons. For those of you who don't know, this channel is primarily funded via Patreon support, which is what allows me to pay really good people to work on this stuff with me. So shout out to all of you. Big shout out to my biggest dogs. I really appreciate you a lot. And I'm currently drinking a beer from my new beer partner, Years. It's an independent company that makes non-alcoholic beer with water from Lake Michigan. It's really delicious. I like NA beer. If you want to try some, you can get it shipped right to you. There's a link down below. Get you 10% off. I don't know. Maybe try it. If you don't already subscribe to the channel, please do that. Leave a comment, like the video. This algorithm shit is so weird, and all the little stuff that you all do to keep up with it really helps out, and it's helping me keep this channel going, so thank you for that. And if you've ever wondered when I post new videos or stream or YouTube's not showing you stuff, consider signing up for my free Patreon. It's free, and you get a notice every time I put something out. So you don't have to pay any money, but you'll always know when I put a video out or when I stream. And because we're talking about getting offline, I want to say a special thanks to CJ the X and Dr. Fatima for including me in the in-person Kill the Internet event in San Francisco earlier this month. If any of you were there, that was awesome. Thank you so much. It was so nice to meet everyone. I would love to do something like that again, and it felt like a really important time to take all the stuff that we talk about on our computers and our little rooms and get together and try to work stuff out. So let's do that more in the future. If you would be interested in attending an in-person event with me and maybe some other YouTube people or writers or comedians, let me know where you live. If you're someone who, you know, knows a good venue or something like that in your town, let me know. If you're someone that runs a venue and would want to host something, let me know. That would be awesome. I'm just going to drink a few small beers and hang out and relax. Thanks for watching. You know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?